I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today is Ben Saunders, the polar explorer turned campaigner and speaker, looking to restore the very Earth he has explored from head to tail. Having skied for more than 6,000 kilometres on polar expeditions over the last 20 years, including a solo skiing expedition to the North Pole in 2001, Ben holds the record for the longest human-powered polar journey in history and the longest solo Arctic journey by a Briton. Ben, welcome to Changemakers. An absolute pleasure to interview you. I want to start with your own self-description. Entrepreneur, writer, cyclist, runner, weightlifter, dog lover, husband. It strikes me this is going to be a high-energy interview.
I don't know about that, but I actually feel sorry for my wife when she gets asked, yeah, what's Ben up to these days? You know, any new expeditions? What's he doing? And I struggle to explain what I do myself. I have one of those job titles with a lot of slashes in it at the moment.
Does it make you quite a fidget, do you think? I mean, are you?
I think I was a fidget. I probably, I'm old enough. I'm 44 now. So I don't think ADHD was around when I was a kid, but I'm pretty sure I would have been diagnosed. I didn't respond well as a boy to being told to sit still with my mouth closed in a classroom and remember things. You know, I like to sort of be obviously outdoors preferably, but kind of doing stuff, trying things, experimenting. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about trying things and experimenting, because I don't think we can start anywhere but with these extraordinary achievements, the record for the longest human-powered polar journey in history and the longest solo Arctic journey by a Briton. I mean, you know, first of all, I would say congratulations on such an epic achievement. But where does that journey start? When do you think that is what I'm going to do?
Good question. It certainly wasn't my careers advisor at school. I blame it largely on a chap called John Ridgway, who I actually saw up in Scotland a few weeks ago. He's now, 83 years old, but back in the 1960s, he crossed the Atlantic in a rowing boat with a chap called Che Blythe. So 93 days in a wooden boat, Boston to Ireland, long before, you know, GPS or satellite phones or even Gore-Tex had been invented. So sort of extraordinary adventure. And I guess rewinding one step further, I grew up without really knowing my dad. You know, my parents divorced when I was very young, 5, and my dad was an orphan. So no family on his side. He actually died last year. And yeah, mum remarried. That didn't work out right. So I as a kid, I think, even as a young man, there was this sort of blank space, you know, there's a sort of gap where I was looking for a role model.
Well, or also, was there something about you wanted to escape something? You wanted to look elsewhere? I mean, you know, in terms of how you might find elements of yourself?
Yeah, I think it was both. I think to start with, I was looking for role model, looking for a template. Like, what does it mean? Okay, I'm getting older, you know, I'm getting a bit of a teenager now. What does it mean to become a man? And looking back, I think I latched onto what now seem almost laughably overblown caricatures of macho accomplishment. It was men, often with beards, of course.
I've seen the photos.
crossing ice caps, you know, climbing mountains, flying into space, you know, all that stuff. So they were my, you know, my role models. They were the sort of people that inspired me as a kid, as a young man, and that's what I wanted to do, I think.
So the spirit of adventure spoke to you very strongly. I mean, what was the first thing that you would say was your first exceptional journey, do you think?
Oof, gosh. It's a good question. We moved, I guess in my teens, we moved to Kent, sort of from southwest to southeast UK. And my brother and I decided to do a walk on the North Downs Way. And I think I can't remember the reasoning behind it. We're both very young. He's nearly 3 years younger than me. So I was probably 15 or something. And we decided we're going to try and walk 50 miles in 12 hours, which would be ludicrous. And we chose, my mum, you know, poor long-suffering mum, you know, dropped us off and agreed to sort of pick us up 50 miles away that evening.
Don't get lost.
Yeah. And we didn't finish it. It was just one of the hardest days of the year. We didn't have enough food or water or anything. I was sort of knocking on people's doors, you know, sort of begging for water, these two kids with their hiking boots on. So there have been a few things like that.
You've done a good job of that answer, because when I asked you your first big exciting adventure and you said Kent, I thought, where is this going to go? But actually, I have walked a bit of the North Downs Way, so I know exactly what a beautiful walk it is. Let's go to some of your bigger expeditions, polar expeditions. I mean, this is the stuff that us mere mortals watch on the telly, right? I mean, you've been there. You've skied it, walked it, you've done it. And tell us a little bit about it.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, the first expedition was 2001. So I was 23 years old. I at that point, had no idea that this could or would become a career. It felt like a once in a lifetime opportunity to join a chap called Penn Haddo, who was turned out to be, in a way, my mentor. Yeah, this was an extraordinary apprenticeship, this first expedition, 23 years old. And the plan was very simply to walk from the north coast of Russia to the North Pole, geographic North Pole. And there are different, there's a magnetic pole, that's where Top Gear drove to, that's the easy one. But the proper one in my books, if you spin a globe, it's, you know, top and the bottom.
They're the easy poles. One, exactly.
Yeah, so it appealed to me for a whole number of reasons, but it was, theoretically, it was going to take about 2 months, about 600 miles in a straight line. And crucially, if you're trying to walk to the North Pole, you're walking over the sea because it's in the middle of the Arctic Ocean, you know, 5.4 million square miles of ocean, bigger than America. So it's a big area of nothingness. Mm. And if you're daft enough to try and walk there, then you're walking over the frozen surface or semi-frozen surface of the sea.
So is it fair to say that the 23-year-old Ben was looking to conquer something? Was that because obviously you've got a different relationship with nature, I'd say, potentially now, but I'm thinking about that early chapter. Was it I want to achieve something?
I think absolutely. I think early on, yeah, my early 20s, there was a lot of ego involved. I don't mean I wanted to show off, but I wanted to do something I could feel proud of. But I felt at that point I hadn't really accomplished anything. I hadn't met university, I'd dropped out of Sandhurst, you know, didn't become an army officer, hadn't really, and I think it came from ego, it came from probably a sort of low self-esteem. Yeah. My early 20s, like wanting to do something significant.
And
how it started.
Doing something remarkable, you know, that you want to remark, talk about it. I mean, tell us a little bit about what you had to endure in terms of the actual experience.
Yeah.
I mean, you make it sound like it was a, you know, sort of like a bit of a quick trip out. But I mean, this must have put you through everything.
I was pretty naive, I think, at the first expedition. I thought I knew what I was doing. I'd been in the army. I'd been ski touring in Norway. I was pretty fit, pretty strong, thought I was pretty tough. And we were dropped by, you know, a couple of sort of rickety Russian helicopters on the northernmost tip of the northernmost island off the north coast of Siberia, middle of nowhere.
That moment, Ben, for us. You get dropped off and the helicopters fly off.
Yeah.
What's the immediate thought?
Yeah, I mean, shock. Terror. Yeah, I don't think I've ever been...
Loneliness?
More out of my depth. Not really, I mean, there are two of us, but definitely right. Feeling isolation. Okay, we're a long way from home now, you know, and might as well have been dropped on a different planet. You know, I think the ambient air temperature that morning we dropped off was minus 48, perhaps. Oh. Yeah, it's so extreme. And you're walking onto the sea and the ice is moving around and it's all quite scary. And oh, there are polar bear footprints and crikey, you know, we're sleeping in a tent tonight and we're doing that for 2 months. Yeah, utterly out of my depth.
Do you remember the first sunrise?
Well, interestingly, it was 24 hour daylight. So we were there in spring, summer. Yeah, but we started, I guess it was late February, early March, so sort of early spring. So the sun is very low and people always say, oh, don't you get bored of all that white? Well, it was, it was terrifying, but beautiful as well. Mm. With a low sun on the sea ice, you know, extraordinary blues and oranges and, you know, colours are glorious. And then it gets brighter and brighter as the sun gets higher.
So who was the Ben that came back from that first expedition? What have you learned about yourself?
Well, pretty humbled because we didn't get to the North Pole. We got two-thirds of the way there on that first trip. You know, came home feeling utterly crushed by this defeat. You know, I was convinced we were going to pull it off. I was going to be the youngest person in history. We'd be the first British team, all this sort of stuff. I'd always imagined, you know, getting back to Heathrow Airport and this, you know, paparazzi and autograph hunters and nothing. None of that happened. And I went back home.
Did you view it as a failure in your mind?
Emphatically in the moment and for the sort of few weeks that followed. And then I got a letter, you know, from a solicitor's basically saying, oh, by the way, and you owe this much money, because Penn and I had agreed to split the cost 50-50. And it turns out, you know, chartering helicopters in Siberia is quite pricey if you go over the hours you'd imagine you're going to use. So I got sent a bill for nearly 35 grand, and I had no money, no job, no degree. My mum and my stepdad just divorced. She was renting a little cottage. I was sort of camping out at her house, trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And yeah, opened this bill for 35 grand. And I thought, I remember thinking, well, shit, you know, I think I was working sort of part-time behind the bar in the village pub at that point. So I thought, well, this is going to take about a decade to pay that off at this rate. So what if I do another expedition next year? Like, so of the 12 expeditions I've done in 20 years, like the first two, almost this sort of Ponzi scheme where I got in so much trouble on the first one. Yeah, the so only way out was through.
You hadn't concluded, if at first you don't succeed, give up. I mean,
that would have been that sort of normal sensible option. But no, I mean, it was interesting. And yeah, people often talk about sort of commitment. I mean, gosh, I couldn't see any other way of
you were back off
out.
And you were back off in months, weren't you? I mean, you didn't hang around.
It was about a year later.
But in the scheme of it, I mean, people might do something like this once in their life if they're lucky. I mean, you were doing this in the scheme of it in a matter of days later.
Yeah, and then it was quite busy. I mean, there were quite a few, you know, sort of 2003, 2004, went to Greenland 2005. So, yeah, it sort of kicked off. And I stumbled into talking about it, you know, and getting paid. I hadn't even realized that was a thing. I didn't do my first expedition thinking, great, I'm going to get on the speaking circuit. That would be fantastic. I didn't understand people got paid to speak. And even if I had understood that, it would have sounded nightmarish to me, age 20, 21. You know, I was pretty shy as a teenager. And the idea of, at that point, of standing on stage in front of hundreds of people, thousands. You know.
And I've heard you speak. I mean, you and I first met each other at an event where I introduced you on stage, I think. And it's kind of like, you know, and it's just the most amazing story when you tell it. And what I took from it was that there were chapters of change for you where you have clearly gone through an evolution of as a person. And we've talked about, I suppose, Ben the Conqueror, you know, sort of like, see, that's the next book, Ben the Conqueror, read on. But then there became Ben the Lover of the Planet, right? You know, that actually you were very conscious and aware of the world that you were exploring. And it strikes me that there have been very clear shifts along the way in your relationship with these incredible natural spaces. Is that a fair summary, do you think?
Definitely. And I think that shift started happening probably 2004. So that was my first big solo expedition. So solo to the North Pole from Russia, 72 days on my own. I was 26 years old. And the first two or three weeks of that journey were, in a way, were the same as they'd always been up until that point. It was, I saw this place as the ultimate crucible, a sort of arena to test myself, pitch myself against, you know, nature at its sternest. And after two or three weeks, I started to get into a bit of a groove, and no longer did it feel like I was battling this place or trying to conquer it. And it almost felt like, okay, I've figured this out. I'm getting better at this now. I don't feel terrified every day. I'm actually feeling a bit more confident now. And it sort of felt like this place, you know, the Arctic Ocean, the pack ice, the Arctic Ocean. I mean, there were lots of sort of weird realizations. One of them was that I was, for a long time, probably the most isolated human being on the planet, you know, for weeks of that journey, middle of nowhere. And also the sort of northernmost human being for a few weeks of that journey. And this sort of thinking, you know, everything, all of the stuff that's going on, all of the sort of, you know, suffering and crime and poverty and corruption, everything, you know, that's all sort of south. And here I am, you know, yeah.
Well, as a Yorkshireman, I can tell you that being the northernmost human being is a great accolade for you, Ben. So,
but beyond that, I think there was this sort of feeling of, I mean, on good days, absolute magic, you know, thinking, wow, like because it's pack ice, it's always shifting. This realization that the scenery, it's beautiful. Scenery I was seeing for 10 weeks of my life, no one else had ever seen before in that particular formation. No one else could ever see again. So I spent 10 weeks of my life on planet Earth seeing beautiful sights that are unique to me.
Like, unique to you. You'll take them with you. I mean, does that really fuel the environmentalism for you? And I mean, presumably you've seen the shifts in nature, you've seen climate change at first hand. I mean, can you give us a sense of actually how it's changed, the kind of the cost to the polls, if you will, in terms of what's going on right now. How have you noticed that shift?
Yeah, it's most obvious. And I don't have a degree. I'm certainly not a scientist, but I am a layman who's been lucky enough to have spent hundreds of days in these places over the last 20 years, more than a lot of career climate scientists. You know, I have this incredibly privileged perspective on how things have changed in the last 20 odd years. And I'd say it's most obvious, you know, to the unacademic naked eye in the Arctic, particularly the Arctic Ocean, Greenland also. But the Arctic Ocean, you know, 2001, Penn and I were dropped off essentially on the beach of this northernmost island and walked onto the ice, went back there in 2004 for this solo trip, and there was about 15 miles of open water. So I was dropped off on the edge of the ice by a helicopter, which in some people's books said, oh, it doesn't count as a proper North Pole expedition. You got flown over there. But I wasn't going to swim, you know, 15 miles to start the trip. And I remember people at the time said, oh, it's a freak year. It's, you know, it'll the ice will be back next year. And of course, it never came back. So it's quite telling that 2004 expedition, you know, solo to North Pole, no one's repeated that. No one's been able to. It could have been a world last in some ways. So,
well, I mean, which would be a tragedy, right? Mm. In terms of, I mean, but it strikes me that the Ben I know is a very positive, optimistic person. But what I see amongst the kind of environmental campaigners is an increasing anger about this situation. We've seen it in recent months with all sorts of kind of big world gatherings. I mean, how do you feel about things right now in terms of actually, I suppose, our custodianship of the planet?
Yeah, gosh. Well, I mean, in some ways, there is so much to be angry about and worried about. But I am an optimist, I guess, deep down. And to me, there are extraordinary sides to these places that actually inspire me deeply, not just in terms of, oh, it's a beautiful place, but in terms of the way that humans operate, particularly Antarctica, which is a continent. It's massive. It's the size of China and India put together. It's 10% of the Earth's landmass. And yet it's also the largest nature reserve on the planet. Nobody owns it. No claims of sovereignty. Governed remarkably well compared to anywhere else on Earth by an international treaty. And one of the things that I love and one of the things that inspires me is that if you are lucky enough or silly enough one day to rock up in Antarctica, no one checks your passport because it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Nobody owns Antarctica. So it doesn't matter where you came from and or what it says on your passport or what flag was flying on whatever bit of Earth you happen to be born on. And the only thing that matters down there is your ability to cooperate with your fellow human beings in a place that is often pretty challenging to be a human being and therefore kind of necessitates teamwork and communication. So to me, Antarctica, you know, yes, there's a deeply alarming story when it comes to the data that's coming, well, both polar regions. But also I think there's a lesser understood story that to me is deeply inspiring about human collaboration in a really challenging situation. So I'm an optimist.
And that I think is very much the theme when you look at things like Earthshot Prize and, you know, the I guess the positive things that we can do. I mean, you know, you mentioned Antarctica, and I suppose the closest thing I've ever been to is watching Michael Palin go there in his great series and that sense of togetherness of the community. And I did feel that when Antarctica rocked up with its first case of COVID, it was almost like the magic had, if you remember, for months, it just stayed apart. And then it almost felt, well, the world's problems are now with it. It brings me on to, you know, we've lived through another extraordinary chapter in the human experience, which is a global pandemic. I would imagine for you personally that would have been a nightmare, wouldn't it, being somebody who likes to be out and about and doing things?
I mean, you'd probably imagine that. I've started traveling again now, but I actually strangely enjoyed it. You know, my wife and I, we bought a house in rural Gloucestershire end of 2018, and then 2019 I was just away the whole time, flying around, whizzing around, giving talks. And then I was working in Antarctica or between Cape Town and Antarctica from October that year until January, February 2019. So I'd barely seen this beautiful home that we'd bought with a garden. And, you know, so in a peculiar way, it was wonderful to be in one place.
And did it give you a chance to focus on yourself in a different way, perhaps, in terms of, you know, I guess, reviewing things, thinking about life, et cetera?
I very much so. A lot of time to reflect. Obviously, there was next to zero travel, way too much time in front of a screen, but also a lot of time to think about the next chapter, because, you know, my last big expedition was 2017, 2018 in Antarctica on my own, 57 days, I think it was. You know, I realized during that expedition that this was now, in a peculiar way, the least adventurous thing I could be doing. I'd figured this game out. And there was some satisfaction thinking, gosh, after 20 years, I've got really good at this craft. And now, actually, this is entirely within my comfort zone, something that would be unthinkable to most people. You know, 2 months alone walking across, you know, half of Antarctica. I'm not saying it was easy, but I'm saying I knew exactly what I was doing. And therefore, it didn't really challenge me in the way that I like to be challenged. So, you know, I always struggle with being introduced as an adventurer, because I'm not a thrill seeker. I don't jump off mountains with a sort of wingsuit on. That's not really, there's very little adrenaline in these expeditions. There's sort of long slogs, really, and lots of time to think and reflect. To cut a long story short, there has been a peculiar lockdown pivot, which is getting involved in a world that I've never imagined myself, which is investment, asset management, you know, which was sort of alien universe to me even 2 years ago.
But you're bringing, I guess, that the kind of green growth agenda into that area. I mean, one thing you did do, you had a tattoo done this year with I'm not saying that's going to go down as one of your life's achievements, but there's a lovely message. I mean, let's just for the video clip, let's have a quick look. It's on your wrist.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to show on Zoom. It's on my wrist. I'm trying to twist my wrist around.
There we go. Ray, isn't it?
Yeah, Panteray. So it's in my wife's handwriting. It's my first tattoo. Had it done age 43. I'm 44 now. But earlier this year. Yeah, in some ways, a little sort of note to self. There was a kind of toss up between that and I think Christopher Hitchens was asked years and years ago in an interview if he had a motto. And he said the closest he had was allons travailler, like let's get to work. And that was it was nearly that because
I think you chose a better one. Everything flows, isn't it? That's what it means. I really like that message because I've often thought about, you know, that there's a great circularity in life. I mean, is that what you were thinking about?
Very much so, yeah. And it's obviously it's from Stoic philosophy. I'm not huge into that, but there's a lot from that makes deep sense to me, probably from lessons I've learned the hard way on these expeditions. Like you have to figure out in the Arctic and Antarctica, like what you can control and what you can't control. And most of the crucial variables, you know, on these expeditions, it's the environment, it's the weather. Clearly it's the wind, the temperature, the visibility, the snow.
The motion of life, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's a lot of stuff that I can't do anything about. And yet if you're not, I say mindful, a bit of a buzzword, but if you're not being, if you're present, not really shepherding your focus, your attention, your energy, it's very easy to get angry at the wind or you know, scared about the crevasse buildings of the horizon. And nothing to do about that. So for me, you know, one of the big lessons of these
screaming at
these
the
expeditions,
wind.
Yeah, is actually
have you ever done it?
I have done it for sure. Yeah, I mean, some of the I often think every other word on these solo has been a swear word. Yeah, but because there's a lot to get frustrated about, a lot to get scared about, and I think that holds true as a sort of, you know, as a useful rule for life. You know, we've all spent a lot of time the last 18 months in front of our screens. Your screen, if it's connected to the internet, will happily give you 24 hours a day of stuff that will make you feel worried, you know, furious, outraged, you know, scared, whatever, but you can't do anything about them, really. Mm. So I think to me that, you know, one of the big lessons from these expeditions is you know, I think it was Jürgen Grobler, the rowing coach. He would say, control the controllables. And again, that goes back to,
you know, well, and I suppose that, you know, that's a message, you know, about how you focus. And I suppose there's something about the physicality of what you do when you're on these expeditions. But I suppose there is an element of the spirit, the soul, that, you know, that's why I rather like the everything flows message. Mm. When you are facing something like one of those expeditions where you just have to spend a lot of time with yourself, if you know what I mean, in terms of sort of facing life where you don't have all of the distractions, the technology, what does it do for you? Is it easy for you, or did you actually find this is, you know, this is very difficult?
I mean, I would say probably more on the very difficult end of the spectrum. But I would also say that I'm probably inclined more towards introversion. I'm happy with my own company. I'm not a raving loner. Like that's not why I wanted to do these solo experiences. Not because I don't like people. That's not the case at all. It was just because that seemed like the highest, the level of the challenge ladder I could aspire to.
So that. It's funny you say you're introverted. I don't think anyone that knows you would use that phrase. You know, you're a gregarious person. I'm sure listeners would agree is that, you know, you come across as a people person, that actually you thrive on the attraction.
I love being I'm back in London right now. I lived in London for 20 years. I love extremes. Yeah, I like complete wilderness, often on my own, and I love cities and the energy that comes with them. So yeah, so I'm always wary of these labels. I heard a lovely line actually on a podcast a few days ago. Somebody said that truth is always nuanced, and I think that's just a really and of course everybody's looking for a soundbite and so much discourse and debate right now is sort of pushed towards the binary and truth is nuanced. I think people are too, characters are too. So I wouldn't say I am an introvert full stop, but I am happy in my own company with my own company.
It's funny. I've had an interview recently with an author where we discussed this issue about the nuance of truth and our truth and the very, you know, the very clear subjectivity issues that come in with that. You know, obviously the truth should be objective, but it brings me on, I suppose, to my final question, which is kind of like, you've got a tip for life, which I think is a great tip. I'll just read it out. It's work hard and be nice to people. So you did get your homage to Christopher Hitchens in somewhere.
Well, that's funny. If I'm not at home. My in-laws have a flat in London. I can camp out in occasionally.
Sure, you've got your feet up.
But I have my sort of normal Zoom background. Annoyingly, my office, my lockdown office, is a spare bedroom, and like a lot of people, it hasn't worked out. So I have my big bookcase. It's just a wall with a poster on it. But the poster is a framed print. I bought it years and years ago. I can't remember the artist's name. Anthony Burrell, I think. It's sort of a screen print. Yeah, but it just says work hard and be nice to people. And I think that's a pretty good maxim for life, and something I try to, maybe I need that tattooed on the other arm, just a reminder, but something I've tried to do. And certainly because I've been the recipient of so much kindness and generosity from people that had no real reason to help me out over the years and took a punt on me, took a risk on me, you know, were generous with their time and advice. So I try to sort of reciprocate these days. And somebody asked me, oh, is there another expedition you're doing? Yeah, I'm more interested now in sort of handing over that baton. I've got no itch to go and put my sledgehammers on and try and break another record. There are different challenges ahead now.
Absolutely wonderful. Ben Saunders, thank you very much for joining me on Change Makers. Changemakers is brought to you by the campaigns firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack, and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works, and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?